Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza. We are your cattle selection specialists. Hey, ladies.
Hello.
Hello.
So we have a pod kind of devoted, we're actually a little bit all over the place, but we've got environmentalism, we've got international history, and we've got adventure, mystery. So it's sort of like we are expanding our horizons, as mentioned. We're journeying out. So it's been an interesting reading month, I think, for all of us.
Yes, I've really enjoyed what I've been reading.
Yeah, and it's fun because we used to do themes in our old podcast, and we've moved away from the strict themes for the podcast, but we kind of have little themes that
come up no
naturally,
matter what.
Yeah. Organically anyway, and I would say you hit on some of them: environmentalism, international travel, stories, and adventure, which ties into something at the end of our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to start out with a book that has all of those themes in it, and it's hard to talk about, so I'm going to try my very best here with this one, but it's called Smoke and Ashes, Opium's Hidden Histories by Amitav Ghosh. And Amitav Ghosh is an award-winning author of nonfiction books, but many fiction books, including the Ibis Trilogy, which does touch on the opium industry, which is what this book is about. And he actually said that this is an instance where his research for the Ibis Trilogy impacted scholars in the history of opium and the opium industry. So that was really interesting, where fiction influenced nonfiction and vice versa. So this is a, if you could see the book, you'd see that I have about 100 flags.
It's very colorful.
And those are parts that were very important to me, which was pretty much half the book, and really interesting. So what this is the story of opium. And it's, he says hidden histories, because if you've, you know about the opium wars, you do know that there's popular histories and there's history written about the opium industry and the opium wars. But to the extent of this book, this is really just the focus of this book. And this is a story of imperialism, of colonialism, and it's about how the British Empire utilized India in the trade to China to correct sort of a trade imbalance. It didn't have enough to export. They wanted tea from China. They wanted things from China. They ran out of gold, essentially. They ran out of that kind of, you know, metal funds. So they used their colony in India, parts of India in particular, and essentially forced farmers to grow opium poppies. This is like the Bihar region. What is the market was what is now Calcutta. And there are lasting impacts of this. Even to this day in those regions of India, they destabilize those regions and they've had harder times recovering than other parts of India. So this is not just about the English Empire, which was, you look at a lot of that wealth in the English Empire, it was from opium exports. But Americans were heavily involved in this too, and I'm going to name some of the names. The Forbes family, the Cabots, the Peabodys. The Peabody Museum had a lot of antiquities from other countries, including China. The Delanos, like FDR's dad's family. The Astors, the Coolidges, and more. I mean, there really are more, and there's a whole section dedicated to what they call the Canton graduates, who received a lot of their seed money or parts of their fortune from the opium industry, and then came back and were very pious and moralistic about things in America. It's an infuriating book, but it's also very informative and fascinating, and you really felt like, oh my gosh, you just pulled so many things together that I really had very little idea of. Maybe I would have had more if I had been a history major. This is what I love about nonfiction. You know, I'm an adult that's way far away from school, but I can continue to learn through books like this. Sometimes you almost don't want to learn all this, but it's like you can't go back once you've delved into it. It's also about the influence of China on the West and how we think of Westernization and enlightenment and these types of ideals, but that a lot of things that we consider in those categories were really from China, like English gardens, heavily influenced by China, art, saris in India, influenced by Chinese fashion. So there's so much in this book that it's just powerful, rich, and I really encourage anyone to read it. It's a readable history. So excellent book, Smoke and Ashes.
It really sounds fascinating. I mean, and some, you know, you hit on things like this in different pieces, but to have that, the full focus of a book is really interesting. Okay, so my first book is memoir. And it's one of those things where you kind of look at it and you think, okay, what am I doing with my life? The book I want to talk about is Bird Girl, Looking to the Skies in Search of a Better Future. This is by Maya Rose Craig. She is a British Bangladeshi birder, environmental activist. She's in that kind of rare group of people. She's seen in excess of 5,000 bird species. She's been birding on every continent. She created an organization called Black to Nature that is dedicated to equal access to nature, especially for visibly diverse groups. And this book came out when she was 20.
Wow.
20. She created her organization when she was 12. She hit 3,000 birds when she was under 10. Her parents are birders or twitchers. She grew up, I mean, they were taking her places as a baby. So she has just grown up within the community. But she is just so passionate about the environment and birding. If you've kind of looked around on different stages, world stages with young environmentalists, she's been there along with Greta Thunberg and the other youth advocates. It's a fascinating book because it's very focused on birding, but it's how birding has shaped her life and view of the environment. But it's also her growing up in the home where her parents looked at their birding trips as ways to kind of cope with what's going on in their own lives. Her mother very, very clearly was bipolar, but she could not be appropriately diagnosed. She was not appropriately diagnosed until Maya was about 10. But they would use the trips would give her mother a focus that kind of brought her out of her depressions, her lows, and gave her a focus. And it brought them closer together, kept them together in a way that they might not have been able to manage. Especially when in kind of lean times within the NHS, they just could not get the diagnosis that they needed. They could get it in certain places, but the important people to further her mother's medical journey would not take the step of actually diagnosing her as bipolar, when she is probably extremely, you know, kind of on the extreme end. So you've got that kind of juxtaposition the idea of a family finding peace in nature, even in a challenging and, you know, birders want birds from everywhere. They will do a lot of interesting things to get their birds, their special birds that they want to see, the numbers that they want to see. But it's still those moments in nature were the things that really grounded her family. And there was a point where they pretty much had to say, and her mother couldn't work. Her mother was a solicitor, put herself through college and got through and was a kind of a rare Bangladeshi immigrant woman in law. But her mental health was just too much to kind of keep up with that. So there's a point where her father's like, we're just going to go. We're not spending money on anything except our bird trips, because that's what we need to kind of keep us together, to keep everybody sane, to keep, you know, everything going correctly. It's just a beautiful book. It's sort of in context because I read, Cheryl's talked about them in previous podcasts, but I've read The Home Place recently because Dr. Drew Lanham was at MSU in March. And I've read Better Living Through Birding. And it's just sort of different views on, I wouldn't consider myself a birder, but I love just sort of sitting out and listening, or sitting out and seeing what's going on in nature. And so getting these kinds of viewpoints has been very interesting to me. And hey, the British viewpoint and the useful viewpoint is really fascinating and cool to me. It gives you hope.
Yeah.
It really does. A lot of things in the news right now do sometimes give me hope in the youth and what they're doing. So it's very cool to see. And her, I can't wait to see what else she does. I mean, again, this book came out when she was 20. And she's got so much time ahead of her.
Right. Yeah. That's been on my list for a while. That one's
and it's a wonderful audiobook. It's a wonderful audiobook.
Does she read it?
She does read it.
Oh, okay. Cool. Neat. Well, I do think that either birding is having a moment or I'm like just noticing it everywhere. You know, sometimes when you all of a sudden get stuck on something, you're like in tune with like every time you see a photograph.
Yeah, I think there is a nature writing trend
definitely.
Very much right now.
People Absolutely. Posting photos or like even when you're not out birding and you find birds that you weren't expecting to see and you get that photograph or you know, things that just really strike you. So, wow, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, this is Mari, and I have the next book. It is The Circuit by Francisco Jimenez, and this is actually a graphic novel version. It just came out, and it has been adapted by Andrew Rosten and illustrated by Celia Jacobs. And this is a book, a memoir that actually came out in the 90s. I thought it was actually even earlier, but it was the 90s. It won all sorts of awards. And it is the memoir of Francisco Jimenez, who's actually now a professor in California. I think he might be in his 80s, but just a classic story. I mean, his family migrated from Mexico in the 1940s, and they did a lot of the migrant labor, like moving from camp to camp. And this is a book, actually, that I've read several times, like in English, in Spanish. I've listened to it. So when I got to read it in graphic novel format, I mean, it's clearly not everything that was in the memoir, but it's presented, it's organized like in these like series of little mini stories or you know, vignettes of what his life was like. And you just see lots of, you know, he had a family, I think, of all boys. Be wrong on that, but you know, they lived in tents. The mom was often preparing meals for the whole camp. They were looking for wood in some of the dumps to make floors for their tents to give more of a semblance of a home. And I never quite figured out, well, how is it that they would take that same home on to the next camp? But so a couple of the stories that really stand out to me. You know, that he had a lot of little brothers. You know, one of them was named Trampita, which means like trickster or, you know, little man who's, you know, constantly trying to give you a run for your money. he was a cutie. But there's another little baby in the family whose name is Torito. And the reason he's named Torito, Toro means bull, and he was born like a really sturdy little boy, big baby, but he got really sick in the story. And, you know, there's this like pages and pages of like, oh my goodness, is he going to make it? And at one point, finally, they take him to a hospital and the doctors are like, well, we don't really, you've waited too long. We don't know if he's going to be okay. And it's just illustrated beautifully. Because Francisco, his name is Panchito in the story, which is like a nickname for Francisco, Panchito. He starts having these dreams about his little brother becoming an angel and flying. And he doesn't really know what that means. But believe it or not, after they go to the hospital, the baby, Torito, comes home and they make this cloak for him. So this is a family who has a version of a very strong Catholic faith. They pray a lot to statues, and they decide that they're going to pray for a full year for his recovery, because they're not really sure if Torito's going to really, you know, have a life. And he does, and they make this cloak for him, and this is like some of the, just it's just beautiful, this cloak for the baby that is kind of modeled on a saint of some kind. It's just beautiful illustration work. The other things that really struck me, at least in the first half of the book, was, you know, Francisco's going to school, as many migrant children do, and they don't know English, and they're trying to learn, and the teacher is, you know, at first maybe frustrated, but eventually just really notices his gifts. He goes on to win an award for an illustration that he does as a child. And he has, and I've read this before, and I'm wondering if teachers out there, is this common? So there's like a lost and found sort of thing. A teacher notices, there's like a closet of clothing. A teacher notices that he doesn't have a coat, and it does get cold in California sometimes at certain times of the year. So he gives him this coat, and later on, one of his bullies, I guess you could say, is like, hey, that's my coat, and he's trying to take it away from him. And just the trauma that happens, I think, you know, this happens a lot in schools, I think, where, you know, teachers recognize that children are without, so they'll pass on something to them. But maybe it does come from the lost and found bin. And another child recognizes that clothing. And you just, I've read this in other stories, and it just makes me think, does this happen a lot? So anyway, I just really want to recommend The Circuit, beautifully illustrated, just an amazing story. And Professor Jimenez is, I just really honor him, and I just, I'm glad that he wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
I love that it's been reissued in a graphic novel format.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, and I think anyone, you know, if you are interested in memoirs of family stories, especially coming to the States, you know, there have been a number of them issued for children and for young adults in the last few years. I Was Their American Dream. I mean, these sorts of books just, they really stand out. And this is kind of more, I think, a grade six on up would be a great, great read.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds excellent. Well, Madi, rereading The Circuit kind of brings us to a little break. We're going to take just to talk quickly about the topic of rereading books. Do you have books that you go back to? We asked our Facebook followers this question last month, and the responses were really interesting and fun. Books traditionally considered classics showed up frequently in the responses, with some examples being To Kill a Mockingbird, Catch-22, and the Earthsea books. And books with the highest number of repeat responses were A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, The Lord of the Rings, and Gone with the Wind, interestingly. While classic titles and authors such as Jane Austen were represented well, more recently published works such as Ready Player One or the Bachman Beartown series, and even go a little bit farther back, Donna Tartt's The Secret History showed up. One person mentioned rereading childhood favorites to her son, and another chimed in to say that she doesn't like to reread books, which, hey, you know what? I can kind of relate to both to some degree. So we thought we'd just take a moment amongst the three of us to talk about rereading books here.
Sure. I think I've told you all before that I reread. It's almost like a comfort read for me. Yeah. It's when I'm not ready to move into something new, or something new is I am being bogged down, or I just need something theoretically that I can put down. It doesn't necessarily work that way, but theoretically I can put it down. I jokingly kind of think of it as I might not start from the beginning and go all the way through. I might be more like I need to, you know, spot check that all my favorite parts are still there. That is my tendency with rereading. And it is. It's totally a comfort thing. It's
yeah. Cool.
Well, I would have to say, for me, it's The Hunger Games trilogy by Susan Collins. And I only say that because, obviously, I was an adult when I read that series, and I didn't, up until that point, never really got into those sorts of books. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of, I don't know, intense, lots of intensity, I guess I'll say, with the considering of, like, you know, taking away lives and just that sort of thing. And I've read it about three times, and I'll probably read it at least a couple more times in my lifetime, just because it just left such an impression on me. And I was impressed that it was, you know, for kids or for, well, young adults, I guess. So yeah, that's something that for me, I didn't necessarily find it a comfort read, but
no, I can understand that.
And it's one of those series too. I mean, there are a lot of movies I choose not to see, and that's one of the series that I'm like, no, I'm not watching those movies because I don't want it to mess with my version of what's going on in my head.
Yes.
That series, I just really, really liked it a lot and have often wished for something else that would like grab me as much.
Yeah.
And kind of, not really, but yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting because it touches on the reason, I think we all are representing different reasons for rereading. Mm-hmm. My rereads are always equine related.
I am not shocked by this.
And so old because of my age that they're not even in Cattle's system anymore, but they're in Melcat. My favorite reread, I don't reread very often. I don't read many adult books very often at all. But I love this book called Someone's Horse by Dorothy Nafis Morrison. I read it in about fifth or sixth grade, and I own a copy, an old troll paperback like the one I had. And anyway, it just takes me right back to being a kid and those summers where I was out with my horse like all the time. And there's just something blissful about it. And I always want to read it in the summer. And I do. I read it whenever I get a chance or I'll take it on vacation. Just brings me right back. I did reread one of my favorite non-horse books I have not read since I was a child. And we do have a copy of it, an ebook. It was called Homesick, My Own Story by Jean Fritz. And it won the National Book Award, I believe, way back. It's like, I don't remember. I should have written this down maybe in the 40s. But it was actually a true story about her being born in China. Her parents were American missionaries, worked for the YMCA in China. And it's about how they had to flee when the revolution was happening. Mm-hmm. And it really, I read it again. It was really good. And I loved it when I was a child. I have not read it since. And it made so much sense to me. It's that it was the kind of book I like to read now. Mm-hmm. It is like the book that sort of touched off like the reading that I love now, which is about
interesting,
history and about a memoir and that experience of being in other countries and the world beyond, you know, little Michigan where I lived, you know. So it was really kind of fun to go back and read that.
Very cool. No, yeah. So yeah, lots of rereading for me.
Yeah.
All right. So in our next section, I think, Cheryl.
Yes, we are traveling back to England. I have a pattern of wanting to read about England a lot, so I try to not do it all the time on the podcast. And so this is two picture books that I'm bringing today on the same topic. The one is called Windrush Child, the Tale of a Caribbean Child Who Faced a New Horizon by John Agard and illustrated by Sophie Bass. And the other one is Granny Came Here on the Empire Windrush, a heartwarming account of the Windrush experience, written by Patrice Lawrence and illustrated by Camilla Sucre. And the one is, the Windrush Child is a lot shorter. It's really bright and vivid for a younger child. And the Granny Came Here on the Empire Windrush is a little bit longer picture book. And essentially, though, they deal with the Windrush generation. And the Windrush generation came about in around June in 1948. Big ship called the Empire Windrush came from the Caribbean and docked in Tilbury Docks in England. And thus began this generation of immigrants from the Caribbean who are called the Windrush generation. And the immigration period was from about 1948 to 1971. And I learned about this through a TV show. And this is, again, one of those things where it's like, how can school teach you that much when you're a youth about these things? But some of the stuff, it's like you just have to learn about it in all different types of ways. And I saw it in a TV show, an English TV show, and I became fascinated by it. So I started trying to dig around and read about it. And these picture books are wonderful because they are for an American child audience. And I just think, what if I had been exposed to this at story time one night? You know, it's just a brief introduction. They have nice pieces in the back with informational facts about the Windrush generation. But how much different would your thinking about things be if you were exposed to so many more of these things as a child? So it's just a fascinating book, both of them, honoring the Windrush generation and the contributions that the Caribbean immigrants made to English culture. And there's a lot of deep diving you can do if you'd like to. The Windrush generation, many of them were very wronged by the English government. Their documents were not taken care of properly, and many of them were deported by accident. Many of them were World War II. They fought in World War II, and they came to England. And they were subject to racism and discrimination, even though they'd fought for they were so excited to come. There are other things like Andrea Levy's books. There's a movie made off of Smile Island that kind of cover the Windrush generation as well.
Isn't like Raymond Antrobus is a Windrush?
Yes, I believe so.
The poet, author of Perseverance.
Right, that is.
I think we've covered a few different
Yes.
Artists from that generation or the next generation in Britain.
Yeah.
Born in Britain. But yeah. Okay.
And there's more of a reckoning of it in England now.
Yes,
there's an honoring from, I believe, the king, current king, about the Windrush. There's like a day of honor. I think it is in June. So, I mean, there's a lot of English reckoning with this and with the opium story as well. I've seen articles recently about that. So.
Yeah, very much. And it is one of those things where I'm not quite even sure where I started hearing about it, but I watch a lot of British television as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it isn't something that was new to me, but it's something that is definitely only learned in adulthood.
Yeah.
Or like explained out, maybe saw bits of it other places, but not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. My second book, I've actually been waiting to tell you about, and it's one of my weird sci-fi books. No, it is When Among Crows by Veronica Roth. So I never read Divergent. I haven't read anything else by Veronica Roth. This is my first book by her. And it is not that. I've mentioned this before, and I will continue to mention it. I really like the tour novellas as a way to introduce me to different authors. And I'm always very interested to see what a writer can pack into a tiny 120-page, a roundabouts book. And in this particular case, I'm also a sucker for a Baba Yaga story. If you're the witch with the chicken-legged house and flies around in a mortar and pestle on other days, she's just a wonderful character in primarily Slavic folklore. In this case, the characters, it's really pulling from the Polish versions of the story. And it's a quest within a quest. It starts, and this first character, there's something interesting about him because he goes into a place he's not supposed to be to complete a quest that he shouldn't be able to complete. And he wants a flower that will help cure somebody, which is at one first glance could be a noble thing, but he wants the flower that would help fully cure somebody because he wants to bargain with that person to figure out if she can help him get an audience, figure out how to get an audience with Baba Yaga herself. And so we have a quest, and then we have another quest, and then we have another quest. And it's kind of painful. It's a little bit grisly at times, but it's really fascinating and ultimately hopeful urban fantasy. It's set in Chicago, a very recognizable Chicago. It's sort of like a creepy undertone of the mythology of immigrants coming to a city and sort of being in the shadows and sometimes a little bit more obvious. And it's just the imagery stuck with me and the character stuck with me. And I kind of just, it was a complete story, but I want more. I want to know more about these characters. I want to know more about this mythology from Roth's point of view. And I just thought it was a really neat book. So that's When Among Crows by Veronica Roth.
Cool. It sounds really good. I like that it's 120 pages. I could approach
there,
that.
There is a plus to that, yes.
Yeah. There's a beauty to the short book, yeah.
Right?
There.
Okay. Well, my next book is The Mystery of Locked Rooms, and this is by Lindsay Curry. It's a middle grade novel. It features three seventh graders, and they are what they call their little group the Deltas, because they're really into solving puzzles. And one of the things they do is they go to escape rooms in their town. I believe the setting is maybe suburban or some sort of a town in Illinois, and they are really good together. They work really well together. They are one of a very, count on your one hand group of people who've been able to solve the most tricky escape room challenge in their town. So they're really proud and they're really excited. And Hannah and Wes, so the three main characters. And Sarah is actually, she's really, first of all, kind of like living in Happy Land? Because, I mean, I'm sure a lot of adults can remember this or relate to this, where you, like, look back on your life and you're like, well, I didn't have a lot of friends, but I remember when I got to this point in my life, I did start to really form, and you just feel like you find your people. Mm-hmm. So this is Sarah's story, because she has, you know, not long ago, but maybe, I don't know, yeah, not in the recent past, has moved to this new town and really found her friends, where before she wasn't sure if she, I mean, it's not that you don't have any friends, but you're not sure you can relate. So she's really happy with these two kids that she spends a lot of time with. But her family is struggling. Her mom is like holding down 2-3 jobs to try to make ends meet. And the reason for that is because the dad, who was once a very happy-go-lucky, very involved father with his kids, has been diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And it's really just changed him, like his personality. He's in bed a lot, and it's been really tough. So at one point, Sarah, you know, very early in the book, shares that, you know, we're in trouble of losing, you know, we might lose our house. We might have to move to Michigan with our grandparents, which I'm thinking is not the worst thing in the world, right?
No, I mean, just well.
Just saying. But they have to come. She's like thinking in her mind, like, what can I do to help? And in the back end of this story is you start hearing about this fun house that was built a long time ago. I can't remember exactly when, but by three brothers. They were triplets who kind of have a sad story of being separated. And they build this fun house when they, you know, as adults come back together, and they hide a treasure inside the fun house.
Well, of course.
But the fun house goes into disrepair. I'm not sure it was ever opened. But they know that there's something in the house. And they look at it as a challenge, like, we need to go over there. And of course, there's no trespassing signs all over the place. People have tried to break in because they've all heard about the mythology of the treasure. And so that's what these kids do, is that they hop a train, end up, I'm like picturing, you know, there's this part of Mason where there's like these open fields, they're like walking from town, all of a sudden it's all rural. That's where the fun house is. And they find a way to get in. This is just the perfect mystery but adventure story, especially for summer, I think. I really liked just how they work together. And, you know, the different little secrets that they find. I'm not going to give that much more away, but I hope you will consider having your middle schooler read it. It's a very good book. Very good book.
Cool.
Very cool.
Sounds fun.
So, hey, it's that time of year again, and we are gearing up for a very fantastic summer reading challenge time. Summer reading challenges, we're talking babies, we're talking kids, teens, adults. Our summer reading challenge is an annual cattle tradition, and this is where we ask everyone to commit to reading all summer long. You know, if you read just 20 minutes a day, it can make a tremendous difference, just by improving your literacy, your vocabulary, just a sense of relaxation. We want everyone to join us. Our theme this year is Adventure Begins at Your Library, as it always does. The Summer Reading Challenge begins June 1st, and it goes through August 3rd. So you can register on our website beginning May 15th. So Summer Reading Challenge time. I'm really excited.
Hard to believe we're here again. Yep. It's exciting.
And it's adventures.
Yeah, we've got some really good reading lists. We've got some great prizes. Yeah.
Some movie lists.
I think Bird Girl is on one of the lists.
Yeah,
all
Bird
right.
Girl.
All
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was on
yep.
one of the lists.
Mystery of Locked Rooms is on the list, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've got some great suggestions, and I think... Oh, I always want to remind people, just because I'm doing it now, audiobooks count.
Yes they do.
Audiobooks, listening
they do.
To
we
an
also have lots of fun
reading.
Activities for you to do with your family or alone, with your neighbors. There's all sorts of ways that you can complete your summer reading challenge. Mm-hmm. There's reading and there are activities. There's writing reviews. We have a long history of just trying to get everyone in our community to join together to read. Mm-hmm. But also just get outside, if we can, put down some of our screens. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice tradition that we do here, and I'm really happy to be part of it.
And parents of, you know, kids, if they're struggling with reading traditional, you know, thick fiction books, graphic novels, there are more and more, right, Mari,
yes,
published all
yes.
the time. That's a great way to get kids engaged with the visuals
right.
as well.
Yeah.
Or magazines and newspaper reading for adults count. So I remember working in the branches for a long time, always getting the question if it has to be library books. That was always a question you'd get every
yeah.
year. And nope, it can be books that you have at home. It can be books you get from a little free library. It can be the back of a cereal
right.
box, whatever.
Yeah.
Reading. We're not
yes.
so into the rules as much as into encouraging
yeah.
reading for whatever that means for you.
Well,
right.
I think people would be surprised at how important the modeling for younger people
yes.
is. Whether you're doing it for your kids or somebody you're on the bus with, you know?
Right?
Yeah.
Yep.
You
yeah.
reading is
yeah.
important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You reading in front of people is important.
Yeah.
It's just a...
And I have to say, Cheryl, I love it when you share books, nonfiction books that are in picture book format, because you learn about so
right.
many different subjects
yeah.
in a short period, whether they be memoir or just something about, you know, some subject that is a short way to learn, like, oh, mm-hmm. I never heard of that before. And you can go off and read, you know, about bionic science or
yeah.
whatever in a more expanded format.
I really enjoyed that when my daughter was younger, whenever she got excited or interested in something, I'd get a book from the library about
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
we'd expand out that way. And I do think that a lot of these ideas, sure, I mean, if you read lots of picture books, you're going to fall out, but it sort of lodges in there somewhere,
right.
not to mention the vocabulary
yes.
that the different books
right.
bring
yep.
and the exposure.
Right.
Empathy, I think, comes a lot from reading
right.
and from adult reading, but
yeah.
for kids, too. There's just so much.
Seeing yourself, but also seeing others
yes.
that, you know, maybe you may never come in contact with
mm-hmm.
A different, you know, family group.
Yeah.
But, it just really opens up your whole world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
All right. So on that note, we will venture off on our reading journeys, and we'll be back next month. Thank y'all. Mm-hmm.